Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, Cindy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alan. I'm happy to be here.
Hey, wow, after looking at all the things you've done, how have you managed to at the same time raise a child?
Well, that's a good question, but Alan, I really worked part-time while I was raising my child. So I believe in the adage, you can do it all, but a little bit at a time. You can't do it all at the same time. So I have to say that I put most of my focus into child rearing, and when my son was in school, that's when I focused on my work and on my writing.
Okay. Now, is that also when you started looking more at the idea of letting them go? I noticed that, okay, so you're a mother of an only child who graduated college
last year.
Okay. And moved to another state to begin his career. Now, was this a difficult transition for you?
Yes, it was. Even though it was a very natural transition, and I knew that it was, and I expected it, I think I was a little surprised to find out how bittersweet it was at the time. And that's because, Alan, I had, like I said a little bit earlier, I put a lot of my focus when my son was younger on being a parent. I really jumped in and was helpful at my son's school. I was really involved in his life, like a lot of parents I know are, and I didn't realize how much I was enjoying that part of my life, even though it was challenging at times. I was really, really enjoying being a parent. So when it came to that letting go time, I had to reshift my focus back to my career and not quite so much on my child. It was time to let him go on and have his life. So I wasn't expecting that. I didn't think it would be quite as hard. I think we often look forward to the time when our children will be going off on their own. We always say, someday I'll be able to do that when I'm not a parent as much and I'll have all this extra time. But at the same time, it's a new phase to get used to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate you sending me a copy of the book, and so I had a chance to read a lot of your columns, and I noticed that there was always sort of a family focus, which I appreciated, and you talked about some of your own experiences as a mother. How did your son feel about being the subject of some of your columns?
Well, I tried to strike a balance between how many columns I wrote about him and how many columns I focused on other family and community topics. And whenever I did write about my son in my columns, I almost always asked him about it, or I made him aware that I was going to be writing about him. I didn't sometimes, though, read the columns ahead of time because I knew he probably, especially during the middle school years, I knew he might be a little bit shy about those. But I kind of got caught one time, Alan, when I wrote about something. It was the topic of teenagers and messy rooms.
Oh.
And his English teacher at school in seventh grade read the paper. I shouldn't be surprised everybody in the community was reading the paper, and she told my son about it in the class.
Ooh.
Which was a little embarrassing for him, needless to say. And I learned an important lesson from that. I learned to respect his boundaries and learned that there were some things that really, even though they seemed very innocent, I mean, this was not a controversial topic, but to my son, it was. It was embarrassing. And he felt ridiculed in school. So I had to kind of call a truce on column writing about him for a few years there. And I had to find other things to write about. That was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. And which was difficult for me because my readers liked the kid columns, as they mm-hmm. called them, and they liked reading about my son and his friends and their adventures. So that made it a little more of a challenge for me to look for other things to write about. But I had to respect him. I had to respect
sure.
my son as a growing person. And so that's in a nutshell.
Okay.
It was kind of a difficult time, but we got through it.
Well, after a few years, did you pick it back up, and did he then see it as a real positive and sort of, you know, made him like a, you know, almost not a celebrity, but, you know, to where it was okay and he was more comfortable with it?
Yes, as a matter of fact, again, now this was a couple, maybe 3 years later when he was in his high school years, he grew a thicker skin, and I think he understood what I was doing, and he knew that I was not trying to embarrass him, that I was, you know, trying to help other families by talking about things that we were all going through. And I think eventually he kind of got a kick out of it. Although I was, again, still very careful. And I unlike a lot of bloggers and a lot of the mommy memoirs that I'm reading these days, I was not writing things that were too revealing about him or too controversial. I did, there were some things that were sacred that I did not write about. But he, later on, Alan, in college, after the book was published, as you know, it's a collection of mm-hmm. columns that were written during that time, and also some magazine essays that I had done on family topics, he told me that he and his friends enjoyed having the book because it was kind of a family album of their life from
nice.
The time they were in grade school right up through high school. So I think he grew to look at it in a different way when he was about 18 or 19. And now he kind of appreciates it.
Well, and as I said, I had a chance over the last few nights to read quite a few of the columns. And
oh, thank you.
Well, and but what I noticed was, I mean, there was very positive things. You know, so, you know, I was thinking, I mean, I could imagine, you know, a young man thinking, hey, that's kind of cool. You know, she's kind of bragging on me. So.
Yeah.
So.
But, you know, in the eyes of, as you know, teenagers, Alan, what we might think is flattering to them, something that we think is putting them in a good light, is still embarrassing to them.
Oh, yeah.
Even, you know, that for a teenager, when you... when a parent just walks into the room, you're doing something embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a delicate balance.
Well, and you're absolutely right. And actually, if I can interject a little story, it just reminded me is that I talk about it on the show, but one of the things that we do at West Shield is we transport adolescents to specialized programs. And I was picking up in the middle of the day a young a Hispanic boy that was living in a very rough neighborhood where there's a lot of gangs involved. And when I got to the house, law enforcement was already there, and they had him handcuffed. And
oh my.
And he was going to go off for an evaluation. And I told him, I said, well, you can take the handcuffs off because I'm going to take him. And they said, well, we don't think that's a good idea. It could be dangerous for you. And I said, no, this is what I do. Don't worry about it. And so we took the handcuffs off, and then the police left, and I talked to him and told him what we were going to go do. And then when we went to leave, he wouldn't leave. And I kept talking to him, and I did what I felt was all of my magic and stuff. And I said, look, I'm giving you an opportunity to walk out of here, to save face. We're going to get in the car. We're going to walk out of here. There's going to be no handcuffs. I'll just be touching you on the shoulder, and we'll walk side by side. And, you know, you're going to be able to. And my thing is save face, you know?
Right.
And I had this whole thing, and I kept talking about it and talking about it and talking about it. And the police came back and kind of laughed at me and said, well, see, you know, you don't know how to do this. And finally I sat down with the boy and I said, you know, what am I missing? You know, is there something that I am missing? And he said, I'm only going out of here in handcuffs. He said, I'm not going to let any of those homeboys out there see me walk out as if it wasn't a big deal, and I went, you know, like a wimp.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Right. And instantly, I mean, it clicked, and I went saving face to him in front of the other gang members that might see, because it was daylight, is that he has to go out in cuffs. That actually gave him more street credit to be taken out in cuffs. And then he was fine, and we got in the car, and I said, can I take him off? He said, sure, nobody can see now.
Isn't that so? It was almost a badge of honor.
Exactly.
Isn't that something?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
isn't that something?
But as soon as you said that, it reminded me of the times in which, as adults, sometimes we go, "Oh, wait a minute, they see it differently."
Yeah, and that's the trick with dealing with teens and parenting them is to try to see things through their eyes, because the way they see things is very different from the way we look at them, not even just the era that they're in, but just where they are in their growth and their development. So as you were saying, what we might think is cool, the pieces that I thought were cool and flattering, were not necessarily the best thing for my son at the time. But again, with the lens of retrospect, as he got older, he
right.
began to see and understand what I was doing. And I think that's true of kids as they get older and get into their 20s. If we can make it past those teen years, they do start to respect us as adults as they become adults, and they see where we were coming from, and we see where they were coming from at mm-hmm. the time. So it's all very interesting.
All right. Well, let me take us back to the letting them go part, because, and I have one who now is very quickly referring to himself as a sophomore now. And I know that many high schools, the one that my son goes to as well, are already preparing the students for college. What can we as parents do to help the kids make the right decision about college?
That's a really good question, and it's a tough one, Alan, because I think we have dreams for our kids and things we want to see them do, or hopes, or we see what their skills and talents are, and we think we know how to direct them the right way. And oftentimes we do. We do have good ideas, but I think we have to make sure and allow a space for the kids to let us know and let their counselors know and the people at school know where they want to go, where they want to go to college, what kind of field they want to go into. And sometimes they just don't know, and that's very scary. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I was a junior and senior in high school before I went into college. In fact, I even went to college an extra term because I switched my major so much. And so I think we have to look with understanding at where they are and not push them too much, but be there with them to guide them and to let them know that we support their decisions. And we also need to take them on the college tours. It helps to take them around to as many places as we can to let them see what college life is like, to talk to the counselors, talk to other students. I also, my son, toward the end, he was accepted at a few different schools, and he had a hard time at first deciding which one he was going to go to. And I had him make a pro and con list for himself, and to make lists of all the things he liked about the one school and what he didn't like about the other. And I was trying to teach him to think for himself, because ultimately he had to live with that decision, not his dad and me.
Yeah, you bring up a great point, because I'm not sure that I know what I'm going to do when I grow up.
Yeah, exactly. And I think too many, I do see a lot of helicopter parenting. I don't know if you've talked about this before on your show, but are a lot of parents. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, no, we haven't. But I was going to ask you, because I've just been starting to hear this catchphrase, and I was going to ask you a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I think especially with some of the suburban parents all over the country, we see it here in the Midwest. I hear about it a lot on the East Coast and out West, that especially among very well-meaning but overzealous parents, they will hover over their high school kids, even from grade school on. They want everything to be so perfect for their kids, or they are very competitive, and it is a competitive world. They want to prepare their kids, and while they're well-meaning, they do a little too much for them, and they interfere a little too much in the kids' lives, which only prepares the kids to fail, because by hovering too much, you're sending the message that you don't think that they are capable, and that they are responsible, and that they can make and take care of some of their own decisions and responsibilities. So I think you have to step back and allow them to grow and to make their college decisions, to make their career decisions, to let them fail sometimes, because I think we do also learn from our failures. And that if we're always shielding our kid from failure, I think in a way we're setting them up for failure in the long run. So helicopter parenting really is, it's hovering too much. It's, you know, following them around at school. I've even heard of parents who will, you know, go to the college admissions directors and try to help their kids get into the college, and or go to bat for the kids when they don't do well in their college exams, who go and talk to their kids' professors. That's, to me, is way too extreme. I don't remember my parents ever getting involved in my college years other than to help me pay for tuition. Yeah, but they let me make my decisions, and they let me fail, and they let me succeed. And I think that's very, very important now.
Well, and I agree, and it goes to the old adage of, I mean, you know, part of our job as parents is that we're supposed to help them be grounded, but we also have to give them wings. If we don't give them wings, they are not going to be able to function on their own. And guess what, folks? We're not going to be there all the time.
Exactly.
That they have to be able to go out and do that. Now, I know that at least I've been hearing more lately in regards to mothers and fathers just having a tougher time letting go of their kids. You know, why are we hearing more about it? Is it happening more, or is it just because, you know, there's so much more information out there that we just hear about it a lot more?
That's a great question. I thought about that too. But I do think with our generation, I'm a baby boomer. As baby boom parents, because we've also been focused on our careers. Sometimes I think out of guilt, my generation, I know I've done it myself, when I've been, you know, busy with work, then I'll kind of throw myself into the parenting a little bit harder. I'll make the extra batch of brownies for the school, and I'll make sure I'm over at the school, as much as I can, again, because we want to be those hands-on parents, and we want to help our kids compete out there, and we want to be the best parents that we can. I think we've been kind of a competitive generation, and we have been the helicopter people.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, if you are hovering all the time, when you have to finally sever that helicopter, you know, you really are worried you're in for a crash. And I think that might be why we're hearing a little bit more about the difficulty of letting go, because we have been hovering so much for so many years. And I know that I have seen it happen. The mothers who were a little bit more involved in the school, maybe didn't have other careers or other aspects of their lives that were fulfilled, they're the ones who really miss it most when the kid graduates from high school and they're not as involved in the kid's activities anymore. Then they almost graduate from high school right along with the child, and that world is over for them. So I think that might have something to do with it.
Well, I think you're right. I think that makes perfect sense, because I know that there appears to be a lot more parents involved. I know that, I mean, I was a room dad until the boys got old enough to the point that they didn't want me to anymore. But in the earlier ages, or in the earlier years, and the initial form said room mom. And when I signed one, and I didn't ask them to change it, but they actually changed the form at that school to room parent, because they said, you know, I was the fourth male that they had had. Now it happens on a much greater, percentage of men that are spending the time there. So yeah, I think you're right. I think that, the closer we are to it, probably the harder it is going to be to break away.
It's like any job, and I should add, I think the parent involvement is absolutely excellent, and I think that is a way to raise good teens, is to be involved. So I don't want for 1 minute to sound like I'm being critical of being involved in your child's life. That's not it at all. But I think it's about balance. It's kind of like the person who spends too many hours at the office. It's not that it's bad to work or bad to go to the office, but you do have to strike a balance in your life and anything that you do, whether it's work or parenting or pleasure. Mm-hmm. You have to make sure you back off a little bit too sometimes and let it take its course. And because I know when some men retire from their jobs, that's a great loss for them and a grieving process to get used to it. And I think people who are very, very committed to parenting, that is a career for them. And when they quote-unquote retire from it, That's a letting go. It's mm-hmm. a grieving for them when that happens.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the relationship between mom and dad. Now, how does it change when the last child goes off to college and parenting isn't central to the marriage any longer? How tough is that one?
I think that's harder than a lot of people think, even though many of us look forward to those years. Again, we often say, oh, when the kids are gone, I'll do this or we'll do this, and yet all of a sudden there you are facing this person. In fact, I wrote about that one time for a piece, and I interviewed several women that I know and then some women online about how they felt facing their spouse after their child went off to college or left home. And every single one of the women told me that it was very hard, even though they were happy to spend time with their spouses, that it felt strange at first because so much of the conversation around the dinner table was about the kids, and the kids were there, and everything was child-focused. And they had become, the marriage had become based on being parents more than being husband and wife. And sometimes it's just inevitable. That just quite often happens when you have kids, and then you're working. So when you're not working, you're parenting. And then all of a sudden that parenting space opens up, and there you are looking at this man and woman across the table saying, who is this person that I married 20-some years ago? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, 18, 19 years ago, however long it's been. You have to reestablish that marriage and yourselves as people. And you kind of get to know each other all over again. And it's fun, but it can be scary, too. Well, it's a little different.
It sounds like the perfect time for a second honeymoon.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely, for taking trips. And my husband and I took a nice two-week trip to Florida when our son graduated from college. And because we knew he was going to be leaving for Chicago, which is in another state, because we're in Michigan, and we walked along the beach and we talked about this was a milestone, this was a transition, and our lives would not be the same anymore with our son not living at home. And that's, I think, real important too, is to talk about it and to acknowledge that you are going through these milestones and transitions together.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to make sure that I touch on a few things before we run out of time. So I know that you write an online newspaper column on midlife issues for the Oakland Press. And also you're working on a book. So if you can tell us a little bit about the book, tell us how you evolved to get to that point, and how we can find it.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, the best thing would be for your listeners to go to my website, which is called Cindy LaFerrell's Home Office, and it's www.laferrell.com. That's LAFERRELE.com. And on that, I have all the information and links to the various places where they can read my writing or order my book. And I do have a link to the Oakland Press, which is a suburban Detroit daily. And they can read the column online. That's the good thing about online now. You don't have to live in the city to read the print edition of the paper. But I write that column for the summer. I'm writing it every other week, but I started out writing it weekly. And it's called Midpoint, and it's about anything having to do with being a midlifer, from being between age 40 and 65, which is how we define midlife now. I talk about everything from facing the empty nest, some of the issues we're talking about now, about letting go of your kids, dealing with teenagers, also dealing with menopause, aging, taking care of elderly parents, that sort of thing. And a lot, I write about how that works from the emotional standpoint, you know, how I'm viewing that, very personal spin. But I may throw in some resources that will help people cope with those things. But as for the book, I'm planning down the road to take those pieces that I'm writing and put them together in a collection that would form kind of a handbook for other people who are going through midlife and just want to feel like they have a friend or a friendly voice along the way. And sort of like what I did with my book writing Home is about the years that I was home raising my son right up until high school when he left for college. So this book hopefully will kind of pick up where that one left off.
Now is
did I answer all those questions?
Well, you did. That was great. And I was going to say, now, is Writing Home also one they can get from your website, or do they go to Amazon, or how do they get that one?
Well, they can. It's available on Amazon. It can also be picked up in bookstores. Now, if most of your readers are on the West Coast, they might have to special order it from a bookstore, but they could do that. They could go into any Barnes & Noble, Borders, or independent bookstore and order it. But again, my website would give them all the information on the various ways they could order it.
Okay, well,
and
great.
The proceeds.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry, the proceeds of the book at holiday time, at the end of the year, I donate a portion of my profits to homeless shelters that serve my community.
That's great. Well, we certainly appreciate it. And, yes, and for anybody, if you were not able to write that down, if you were driving, you can also go to our website. It's answers4thefamily.com. And any questions you have for us, we will pass them along to Cindy. Cindy, I want to thank you so much. I am what you speak of. I am also a baby boomer. I am also at the same level. And I've got a teen and a tween myself. So, I appreciate it very much. And I believe the listeners do as well.
Well, thank you so much, and I wish you luck with your teen and your tween and this time of transition, too. Thank you so much for having me on your show, Alan. It was a lot of fun.
All right. Take care now. Bye now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, you're back with Answers for the Family, and I believe we have on the line Brad Edgar. Brad, are you with us?
I am here.
That is great. Boy, I'm pushing these buttons and making this stuff work. I'm just kind of proud of myself right now. Brad, before we get started, let me tell the listeners a little bit about you. Okay, Brad is the Chief Operating Officer and the Shelterwood Director. For the past 20 years, Brad has helped families in crisis through his time as a Shelterwood Big Brother, Shelterwood Director, Therapist, Counseling Director, Executive Director, and now in his position as Chief Operating Officer. A Springfield, Missouri native and Denver Seminary graduate, Brad is married with 4 children of his own. Brad, welcome to the show.
Wow, it's really nice for you to let me come on today.
Well, we appreciate having you. Now, obviously, I've mentioned Shelterwood. Can you tell our audience a little bit about Shelterwood, when it started, and just open up and tell us a little bit about what Shelterwood's doing? You've obviously been there for a long time.
Yeah, I have been a part of it for a long time, and it's had a huge impact on my life personally, and now it's a pleasure to work for it professionally. Started 1980 in Branson, Missouri. Started by a man named Richard Beach, who was a guy who was trying to train young men and women for jobs in ministry. And he had a real heart for training leaders. And he started by having about 6 guys live in his basement in 1980. And they had classes together and lived together and worked together. And at the same time, he was working for a camp in Branson called Canicut Camps. And one of the camp dads called him one day and said, Richard, I'm having trouble with my daughter. She's staying out late at night. She's getting in trouble. I think she's drinking. I think she might be using drugs. I don't know where she is half the time. And so finally, we were trying to find help, and we found out the only help we could get was either for her to go into the juvenile justice system, jail basically, or go to a psych ward at a hospital. And so she ended up at the psych ward, but he called, this dad called Richard and said, I need help. She doesn't really belong in the psych ward. She doesn't really belong in jail, but we need help. And Richard, being who he was, he said, I'll come get her. And he drove down to where this girl was, and he picked her up and brought her back to Branson. And he said, I'll play the role of the dad. I have a girl that works for me that's right down the road, and she'll be the big sister. There's one of the six guys that lived in his basement had a counseling degree. He'll be the counselor, and we'll see if we can help your family. And sure enough, that girl turned her life around that year. And Richard kind of thought it was over. Mm-hmm. And then that next summer, that same dad called him back and said, Richard, I know other dads that need help with their kids, just mm-hmm. like we did. Would you be interested in doing this? And at first he said no, and then the guy talked him into it, actually paid for the first log cabin, and we started taking kids in then and got licensed, and now we're a residential facility for struggling teenagers. We have programs in Branson still, and we have one in Independence, Missouri, which is just right outside of Kansas City.
All right. Well, tell us a little bit about, what makes Shelterwood unique? Because for those that aren't part of this industry, it's an industry that over the last 20 years has just exploded. I mean, so there are many, many programs out there. But what has come of that is first of all, everybody's raised the bar. So it's a very professional industry. People have raised the bar, and there's a lot of great things happening. And the programs that have really thrived have found certain niches or certain things that make them unique. And Shelterwood is one of those. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think what makes us unique and has made us unique for the last 30 years is our relational approach to helping struggling teenagers and mm-hmm. hurting families. The first model of the first girl that went through the program, she had a big sister, and that's what we called her back then, and we still have these big brothers and big sisters that form deep and lasting relationships with these kids. And we've seen over the years how those types of caring, loving, supportive, encouraging relationships make a difference in the kids' lives. And so the way we do it is we recruit these big brothers and sisters from all over the country, mm-hmm. and they actually volunteer an entire year of their life. They live in the house with the kids 24/7, live in the room with the kids, and they serve as their friend, their confidant, their authority figure, and walk them through the struggles that they have. Now, we at the same time have therapists, master's level therapists that work with the kids, and like everybody else, we've really grown into a very professional organization. But the heart of what we do is that relational, life-on-life relationship that makes a difference, and I think that's what continues to make us unique.
And how do you match them up? So let's say that there's somebody out there listening, and they're 24 years old, and their goal is to be a therapist. Maybe they're in their they're in their bachelor's program. What sort of information do you get that that they're a good fit with with Kathy, or a better fit with Mary?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there is no better training for a career in therapy, in psychology, in family therapy, than what you go through living a year with these kids.
I bet.
I did it. That's how that's really sparked the fire in me to pursue this as a career. I was a big brother, mm-hmm. living in the room with three boys. And it was challenging, and it stretched me, and it really started that fire in my heart. And later I got my master's degree and have made this my life's calling. But we recruit all over the country. I said that before, and we try to find people who, first of all, have a heart and a desire to work with kids and to work with families. And I think, Alan, you and I were talking a couple of days ago, and we said, you know, this work is a calling.
Yep.
And sometimes, you know, when you tell people what you do, they kind of look at you like you're a little bit crazy. Now, you really want to do that? But it's a calling, and it's something I love, and we look for those people who have that same kind of calling in their life.
Well, they
might be folks who are studying psychology in their bachelor's degree, who are getting ready to go into their master's, but they want a little bit of hands-on training. And then obviously we screen them. We do criminal background checks and all the things that you have to do, and so we know they're on the up and up and get lots of references. But we look for the heart of people who love kids and want to help.
Mm-hmm. Well, when did you know? Was there any particular point at time that you knew that this was your calling? You know, I mean, it takes a lot of heart to dedicate your life to other people's teenagers, not to mention having four children of your own.
Yeah. You know, it was an interesting and really amazing process for me personally. Like I said, I had been involved in different campus organizations and actually volunteered at my church and worked at camps with kids. And so I thought I loved teenagers. I knew I loved teenagers, and I loved working with families. And then I found out about Shelterwood and the Big Brother program, and I signed up for it because I knew some of the people in it. And during that year, it was one of the most challenging years I've ever faced, right?
Mm-hmm.
All the issues that they're dealing with and the complexities of that, and it was exhausting. But at the end of the year, I knew it was one of the richest and most powerful years of my life. Now, right away, I thought, well, that was a great experience. And then I went off and actually worked again in youth ministry and in Christian youth ministry. But as I was doing that, I found myself longing for the depth of relationship that I had with the kids in Shelterwood. Even though it was hard, it was stretching, it was trying, the depth of relationship, being with them all the time, working with them, you know, laughing with them, crying with them, helping them with their homework, late night counseling sessions, you know, impromptu because they had a tough parent call. Whatever it was, I longed for that depth of relationship, and I longed for the healing that came in their life through that type of relationship, that type of mentoring, life-on-life relationship. And that's when I knew that that's what I was called to do.
Now, how do you think that helped you with your own children?
Oh, wow. I could talk for hours on that.
Well, okay, the Cliff Notes version, because we've got about 10 minutes.
I won't do that. But with my own kids, you know, I learned a lot. I learned about the importance of relationship from seeing, and I've learned that over the years as I've been a therapist in the program and a director and other things, that a lot of times the kids that come in who are struggling, there's a lot of issues. There might be some addiction issues, depression, you know, a lot of those things. But a lot of them, too, are really lacking that type of safe, in-depth relationship with their mom and their dad. And that sounds crazy, but it really happens a lot. And for whatever reason, dad might be busy working, you know, providing for the family. Mom might be, you know, running the home. But somewhere along the line, there's a break, and the relationship has been damaged, and it has suffered. And by seeing that, and the importance of healing that relationship, it's taught me that I've got to work hard every day at maintaining a good relationship with my sons and my daughter. That doesn't mean I'm the dad who's the friend, right?
Right.
I'm still their dad.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important to keep a good, strong balance. You know, for as much as I might need to discipline them, I need to make sure that's also balanced with times where I'm just, you know, maybe at night laying down in bed with them and talking about their day. right?
Mm-hmm.
That I might be involved in activities that they love to be involved in, and just taking the time to do that and making sure that that strong balance is happening in my life and my relationship with my kids. And the unfortunate thing is, or not, it's not unfortunate, but the reality is that work needs to be done when they're younger.
Yep.
A lot of times, by the time they're teenagers, if you don't have that basis of relationship, it's really hard to get it back. Not impossible, but it's really hard because you're catching up.
I agree.
And I see that all too often with some of our families.
Well, let me ask you something in regards to Shelterwood, and it's one of my pet peeves, but how do you help so the relationships that they gain while at Shelterwood last beyond Shelterwood?
That is a great question, and is one of our greatest challenges, to try to figure all that out and how do you maintain them. But what we found is it is not with all of them, but a large majority of them, because of the nature of the program, they last. I'm in touch with kids that back when I was a big brother, and that was in 88, 89.
Wow.
I still have contact with some of them, and they're grown adults with kids of their own. Kids I counseled 10 years ago. These big brothers and big sisters, they form keep relationships, and it sticks with them, and they follow up. One of the girls that I counseled when she came in, this was probably 15 years ago, she came into the program like a lot of them, you know, dark. Her whole life was dark, dark clothes, dark makeup, mm-hmm. you know, black eyeliner, black lipstick, and that just reflected her life and her insides. It was dark and hopeless, and she was a hurting girl, and she made it to the program, and a lot of ups and downs, ended up graduating, and then even after her graduation, she struggled for a few years with addiction still, and I kind of lost touch with her for a few years, but then after a while, she gave me a phone call, and then she started writing these letters, and she told me her story about how she left and she'd struggled and kind of gone back down into the pits a little bit, but she never forgot the relationships she formed at Shelterwood. And as she started to realize that she needed help turning her life around again, she recontacted me. She recontacted her big sister that was there, her house director, which is another person in the house that lives there with them.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the relationships that were the foundation for her turning her life around. And today she's married and just doing excellent.
Right.
And it's that kind of natural progression of those relationships that are really important.
Right. And I think even more than that is there had to be a huge, huge amount of trust to be able to,
yeah.
to be able to go back to those people. And first of all, talk about the fact that you did slip.
Yeah.
But the trust factor to know that they're not going to judge you, they're going to help
yeah.
you. I think that's huge.
Yeah, that's what we found, that they come back to those relationships. And, you know, the thing about our Big Brother and Big Sister program is that, you know, they're really volunteering for a year. Now we train them, we put them through classes, have mentors for them. And so it's kind of a program. The Big Brothers and Big Sisters are in their own program as well, learning how to be leaders, learning how to work with families, learning how to be with teenagers, or work with teenagers, right? And but the kids look at that and they go, well, these aren't folks just collecting a paycheck,
mm-hmm.
right? They're at first they're kind of blown away. They're like, wait a second, you're not here for just a shift and they're leaving later on?
Right.
You're here for a year and you live here and you're volunteering?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that whole look of going, are you crazy? But they learn that they're there for them, and that trust is built, and then that's a trust that lasts a lot of the time for a lifetime.
Well, I think that's incredible. Now, I know we've
yeah.
only got about 4 minutes left. I know that you are opening a new facility, or I believe you just have opened a new facility outside of
yeah.
Kansas City, Missouri. Can you tell us a little bit about the facility, why there's a need for this facility, and you know, and what's special and unique about it.
Yeah. Well, we opened. We still have our original campus in Branson, and that's going well. We had a facility in Denver, and people will say, "Well, why on earth would you leave Colorado and go to Independence, Missouri?" And the reason is the property we had in Colorado was just really overtaken by the city of Denver, and it doesn't really that's not really conducive to the type of kind of a peaceful, tranquil type setting that the kids really need to find healing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came across a 200-acre piece of land out here in the woods outside of Kansas City. It's never going to grow around us. An old YMCA camp, beautiful piece of land, trees and creeks and hills, and so we knew that that's where we needed to be. So we've built now 2 15,000-square-foot lodges on it, and a big field house which has a gymnasium and an exercise room and a school, 5 classrooms for our school. We have an accredited school on site that our kids go to, and so we have a beautiful school building out here, and it just afforded us the space and the location just afforded us to be able to build these facilities for the program to function the way it really should. And so we're really excited. It's going to triple our ability to minister to and to help families and kids. And we're just really excited about it.
Well, and you mentioned minister to. Tell us a little bit about the role of spirituality in the Shelterwood programs.
Well, we consider ourselves first and foremost a Christian ministry. Again, we've kept up with the industry, so to speak, in terms of professionalism, and our counselors are trained, and our programs really well run. But at the heart of what we're about, and it goes back to our beginnings, is we're about restoring families, and we believe that counseling is great and important. We believe that education is great and important. Obviously, we have an accredited school, and kids graduate from our school and go on to college, etc. But we feel, you know, real lasting change happens at a heart level. And at the heart level, it's about a teenager's spiritual relationship to God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where healing comes from. That's where forgiveness can be found. Now, we certainly don't force our kids, and a lot of our kids come through and they never really become a Christian, if you want to put it that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't force it down their throats by any means, but we do encourage them to look at the spiritual aspect of their life and how that can affect their ability to forgive, their ability to heal in their life, and ability for the families to heal. And a lot of our families are looking for a program that reflects their values and their morals and their beliefs, and that's where we fit.
Well, Brad, I want to thank you. We are just about out of time. Can you give us real quickly, how can people get in touch with you, the website, email?
Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio.